Winning is an everyday mindset, and on the Ways to Win podcast, coaches Craig Robinson and John Calipari are here to help. Each week, Craig and Coach Cal use their on-court wisdom to solve off-court problems. They'll talk about the latest news in college and professional basketball with coaches like Jim Boeheim, former players like Stephanie White, basketball analysts like Grant Hill, and more. Revealing insights that made them into the leaders they are today. And don't miss President Obama, sharing how he deals with pressure by projecting confidence, believing in your team, and taking criticism.
You don't want it. You don't need it. But you're going to get it anyway. The Kevin Sheehan Show. Here's Kevin.
All right, the show today is presented by MyBookie. Go to MyBookie.com or MyBookie.ag. Use my promo code KevinDC and they'll match your first deposit. Dollar for dollar, all the way up to $1,000. They've got some prop bets up right now for the Super Bowl, so beyond this weekend. Right now, Tommy, as Tommy joins me from Florida, the favorite to be the Super Bowl MVP, and he is a massive favorite at minus 570 is Patrick Mahomes, followed by Joe Burrow, and then Matt Stafford and Jimmy Garoppolo. What's interesting is that, you know, the Bengals play the Chiefs in the AFC title game. The Rams and 49ers play in the NFC title game. So I would have thought that the favorite would have been Mahomes. That's the obvious favorite, and he's a very, you know, big-time favorite to be to eventually be the Super Bowl MVP. But I would have just thought that the second favorite would have been the NFC quarterback, you know, Stafford, because he's got a chance to get to the game. Whereas Burrow, if Mahomes is the heavy favorite, won't even be in the game. But they're saying essentially that the winner of the AFC championship game will be, you know, I don't know if they would be favored actually over the Rams, but that Joe Burrow would be a big part of it, and therefore Joe Burrow is the second favorite. The long shot to be your MVP, Tommy, Jimmy Garoppolo plus 4,000. You wager $100 right now on Jimmy Garoppolo to become the Super Bowl MVP, you win $4,000.
That seems like a good long shot to me.
It's a big time long shot at MyBookie. Yeah. MyBookie.ag, MyBookie.com. Use my promo code KevinDC. And most importantly, you will double your money upon your first deposit. They're giving away money. Even if you've got a place where you're already gambling, take the free money, take the place to comparison shop on point spreads, lines, money lines, you know, price, etc. At mybookie.com, mybookie.ag. What's going on? How you doing?
How you doing, boss?
Did you enjoy the football?
Down here in Florida.
Did you enjoy the football?
Oh, yeah. Very much so. You know, it's a transcendental game when my wife watches and is interested in it, as was the Chiefs-Bills games, and talked about it the next morning.
That's
basically transcended football fans, that kind of game.
That is so interesting, because at my house on Sunday, the day started with four of us in the house, okay? My wife, me, my middle son, who lives in Baltimore, with his girlfriend. They were over at the house. And my wife, as you know, couldn't care less about sports or football. And my son's girlfriend, who is also, like my son, a musician, she's a wonderful singer, an artist, she really couldn't care less. I mean, if she weren't with my middle son, she wouldn't even know they were playing these games. And so the Rams-Buccaneers game is coming down the stretch, and, you know, my wife's listening to what's going on. The girlfriend is not in the room with us. She's doing something else in the other portion of the house. I think she was actually playing piano. We're kind of yelling a little bit about here comes Brady, yeah,
here
and
comes
the Buccaneers.
Brady.
So my wife jumps in. She's like, and she just says, "Is he going to do it again? Is this really going to happen again?" And so she stuck it out till the end of that one. But my son's girlfriend, nowhere to be found. But at the end of the Chiefs-Bills game, My son's girlfriend, Riley, she's a wonderful girl. Couldn't care less about sports, has no idea what's going on, like my wife. She literally came down in the at the end of regulation, and she basically said, like, this is the number one trend on her Twitter, on her Instagram, and she wanted to see what all the fuss was about. And so there were four of us there for the end of the Bills-Chiefs game in overtime. And I think that probably happened, you know, in a lot of places, that people who aren't really into sports, you know, I'll give you another example. I was listening to Howard Stern yesterday, briefly. You know, Howard, I'm a huge fan, and I've had Sirius XM forever because of him, really, more than anything else. And he is not a sports fan at all. And he really kind of scoffs, you know, at sports. He doesn't know anything about sports, which is okay. Although, I think it was you who told me once, didn't you tell me once that you're leery and a little bit, non-trusting of guys that say they don't follow sports? Was that you?
No, that wasn't me.
Okay. I'm trying to think of who that was. Somebody said, you know, I just don't believe a dude when he says, I'm not into sports at all, and I don't trust that guy. I forget who it was in my life that said that, but I actually have one of my closest, oldest, dearest friends who I was in business with for many years, probably had no more idea than anybody that these games were even going on. And so
I have three brother-in-laws in my family. None of them care a lick
right
about sports.
Yeah, I have people in my life that are the same way. Obviously, my wife being the closest. However, back to Stern. I turned on Stern when I was in the car yesterday, and all they were talking about was the Chiefs-Bills game. And Howard was a little bit incredulous, and they were talking about the Bengals game too, because JD is a Cincinnati fan. And anyway, they were going back and forth. And I still got the sense that Howard just still doesn't get it. And I would say to somebody like him who loves to be entertained, it's one of the great reality shows in entertainment. Forget that it's sports. It's an incredible reality show because you have no idea what the outcome is. You know, you don't know. It's not, you know, it's not a sitcom. It's not a television show. It's not a movie that you can watch once and then watch over again. And Sunday, it played out four times over as the greatest reality show on television, which is the NFL.
I agree 100%. You know, I'm loath to use the term reality because what we've come to believe are reality shows, I don't think are reality at all. I think most reality TV under the guise of reality is like professional wrestling with a scripted ending.
Okay.
Okay. But we're going to believe that these are not scripted endings, that this truly is reality television. And here's the thing about football, and I mean, this is my first time really verbalizing it and thinking about it, because basketball is dramatically athletic. Okay. A dunk, it's a dramatically athletic sport. But it happens in brief moments, you know, those dramatic athletic moments. A dramatic athletic moment in a football game can unfurl over a course of, 5 seconds, 6 seconds with a 60-yard run down the field.
Right.
You know? I mean, and I think that's what makes it so much more appealing to non-sports viewers, is they can appreciate the drama that's taken place with somebody running a 60-yard run. You know, you don't have to know anything about football to recognize that's a dramatic moment. So I think that has a lot to do with the attraction of non-sports fans. When they're in a game and you're seeing one dramatic moment after another in the Chiefs-Bills game, that's what I think brings in the non-football fan. You don't need to know anything about football to appreciate a guy catching a 60-yard pass on the run and running into the end zone.
I get what you're saying. I think every sport has you know, those areas in which you can say that's the part that draws him in. I know what you're saying with respect to a play that plays out over 6 to 7 seconds athletically. You know, and by the way, the drama then builds in between, you know, the 40 seconds in between plays, just like it does in baseball in between pitches. There's a drama level there that builds. Hockey is nonstop. Like, I think the one of the greatest things as a sports fan to watch, and I think one of the most dramatic things, and one of the things that's nonstop on your on the edge of your seat, is an overtime NHL playoff game, because of the sudden death nature of it, and it can and so many, it literally you don't have to wait more than typically 15 seconds for the next opportunity where you think it just almost ended, and then all of a sudden it does. Basketball. I mean, the athleticism and the shots and the different things that can happen can be totally wow moments. But I think I understand what you're saying. I mean, there's also football takes over this country in terms of numbers, which then sort of manifests itself on social media. Like, you can be totally oblivious to the fact that this Kansas City Buffalo game is going on. And yet, if you're on your phone and you pay attention to social media, nothing's going to light up anybody's social media like Sunday afternoon did. No NBA game, no NHL game, you know, no World Series game like what happened. Because they're, you know, literally, I'm going to guess that probably 60 million plus people were watching that game. The numbers will come out. It's going to be an outrageous number. I mean, the Dallas 49ers wild card game, which wasn't in prime time in the wild card round, drew an average of 41 million viewers, and it peaked at just over 50 million. So I would guess that the Sunday night game, given how competitive it was, I bet you that this game may have averaged 60 million viewers. It's unbelievable.
It really is. I mean, and you know, then the next morning on news talk shows, you know,
news.
Morning talk shows, it's the news. It's dominant.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Somebody, I don't know who it was, I saw this tweet and I just laughed. It was like, after one of the greatest weekends in the history of the NFL playoffs, and maybe, you know, arguably the greatest game or greatest finish, you'll turn on ESPN the following morning and they'll be talking about LeBron James. Somehow. I don't think that's true, by the way, but yeah. So what were your, so give me some of your big takeaways from the weekend.
Well, I think the 49ers showed a toughness that I didn't really think about before. You know, I don't think Kyle Shanahan's teams are necessarily associated with being tough, physical on defense. And they lost their defensive coordinator, didn't they? He wound up getting hired by the Jets, right?
He still has in New York, yes.
But, I mean, that was the one thing I was impressed with the four, because I mean, it was not a good game necessarily. It was a close game, but I mean, no, neither team played particularly well offensively, but the 49ers just toughed it out, you know. And I was impressed with that on the 49ers game. I was disappointed that Brady didn't do it again. Okay. I think it would have made for a great story if Brady had managed to pull off another upset again. I mean, when you're sitting there watching the game with somebody who doesn't know football, and you explain to them that he was losing the Super Bowl 28-3 and wound up winning it, you know, their jaw drops.
Right.
You know, they can't believe something like that. So, I was kind of disappointed that Brady didn't win, just for the sake of the storyline. And as far as the the big game, the Chiefs and the Bills, I couldn't believe all the whining about the overtime rule after the game. I just was, it was like We were having a nice, friendly, manly event, and then all these whiners jumped into it and say, "I want the ball. I want the ball." You know?
Yeah.
They had the ball, so I want the ball. God almighty.
So that's actually a good segue into something that I want to talk about, and we'll do it right here. I wasn't planning on doing it. And that is the overtime rule, because I've rethought my position from yesterday. But let me back up real quickly. Where does Chiefs Bills 42-36 overtime, you know, 2022 postseason, where is that for you? You and I have both watched a lot of NFL playoff games over the years. Did you even think about it in terms of, you know, this is the greatest I've ever seen, or it wasn't as great as, you know, because you do that a lot of times, and so do I. It's like, sorry, but do you remember this? Because I was there or whatever. But where does it rank?
You know, it has to rank, I think, probably top five. I mean, everything else is subjective. You can't call it the greatest game ever. I mean, the greatest game I ever saw involved the Chiefs. It was the Chiefs and the Dolphins, the 1971
Christmas Day
divisional round game that went to two overtimes.
Christmas Day,
1971. And the Dolphins won 27-24.
Longest game in NFL history still today.
Yeah, that's the greatest game I ever saw, and I watched it when it was happening. And I'm not going to argue with you if you say that this is a top five game, but don't sit there and say, like the world started yesterday, that's the greatest game ever. That's my only argument with it. Really, you can only argue for where it fits among the greatest games ever.
Yeah,
that would be my opinion.
So,
I mean, I think the 71 Dolphins Chiefs is my greatest game.
So, I mean, it seems like, and I think I mentioned this with Scott yesterday because I had Scott on the podcast, I talk about this all the time when we see something great. Like, I understand what we've all become. I don't know if it's a last, you know, decade or two decade thing, or maybe it's just my imagination that we're so much more prone to hyperbole, you know, based on something that just happened, you know, the recency bias thing. But I said to you 2 weeks ago that the Chargers Raiders season finale is truly going to go down as one of the most memorable regular season games of all time. And I tried to really, you know, stay medium, as Jim Zorn would say, because I didn't want to go overboard, but it really was. I mean, I just sat there and it was jaw-dropping, you know, over that 3.5, almost 4 hour period. I think Sunday, and I think I said this yesterday, I think it will certainly be one of the most memorable finishes in NFL history. I mean, we've never seen 25 points scored in the final 2 minutes of regulation.
No.
And, you know, the field goal in 13 seconds to get into range and then overtime, etc. But for me, and I don't remember the Dolphins-Chiefs game watching it. It was Christmas Day 1971. Now, I have watched it, and I've read about it, and I've seen all of the documentaries, you know, and the various, you know, shows that have been done on that Chiefs-Dolphins 71 game. It's still the longest game in NFL history. It went deep into the second period. It went 7 minutes and 40 seconds into the second overtime. But for me, and I've always felt this way, the Dolphins-Chargers game in January of 82 following the 81 season is the greatest start-to-finish playoff game I've ever watched. It was so compelling from the start to finish because it had the back-and-forth nature, which I think is a big component or a big part of what makes a great game. The Chargers were up 24-0. Early in the second quarter. And then the Dolphins came back, and at the end of the first half, they hit on one of those hook and ladder plays. Don Strock off the bench, and Tony Nathan ends up being from Duriel Harris on a hook and ladder, and it's 24-17.
Clock stop with 6 seconds to go.
8 first downs, all passing. What are you going to do, make a nice 4-yard gain in that position?
throws to Canton.
Don, what'd you ask me? He said, what do you do when you ever get in a makeup offense? This baby was designed, not today, but several weeks ago. It's in the playbook. It's a great place by play by Duriel Harris to hit him on a dead run. It's not something you work on every day. It takes great players to execute it. They made it in an unbelievable moment.
And then the Dolphins, from 24-0 down, take a 38-31 lead late into the fourth quarter. But then the Chargers come back, and they force overtime. And that game went to a second overtime period with Kellen Winslow blocking not one, but two field goal attempts after catching 13 balls in the game. One of the greatest individual performances I've ever watched. The heat, the exhaustion, the physical distance in which those teams went, I think that's the greatest game start to finish that I've ever watched. But Sunday...
I can't argue with that, by the way. I mean, that would be my 1A among the greatest games I ever saw. I remember watching that on TV as it unfolded as well. That was great. It was absolutely great.
But it was... It was a phenomenal game. So your overtime thing. So let me just say that I personally in the aftermath of the game, I those are the rules. You know that those are the rules. You know we know them as NFL fans, and it's not like we haven't debated the overtime rules previously. We have, and a lot of people haven't liked the overtime rules. They've changed over the years. In 2010. The NFL went to this got to score a touchdown on the opening drive, but that was only for the postseason for a few years. You know, the regular season still ended in sudden death with a field goal, you know, but then in 2012, they moved the overtime rule in the postseason to the regular season, and we've been dealing with this rule primarily. Except for the change in time, regular season has gone from 15 minutes to 10 minutes. That happened a few years back. But we've been dealing with this, you know, you got to score a touchdown on the opening drive to end the game to end the game in overtime, if not the other team gets a possession. The whining about it in the moment is ridiculous. We've known what the rule was. The Bills and the Chiefs knew what the rules were, and those are the rules. However, my position actually over the last 24 hours has changed on overtime, because I think with Scott yesterday, I essentially said, yeah, I don't need it to change. I don't want it to change. I don't need it to change. If it does change, I'm okay with it. But now I want it to change. I did a lot of thinking about this yesterday, and I had several conversations about this yesterday. And I learned something that I didn't know. So Lewis Riddick tweeted something out yesterday. He tweeted out, of the 163 overtime games, regular season and playoffs, under the current overtime rules, only 35 of the 163 were decided by touchdowns on the first possession of overtime. And then he wrote 21.5%, !! Four exclamation points from old Lewis Riddick. He writes, don't tell me coin flips are deciding games in overtime. Strategy and execution does. And then four more !! And, you know, the argument, by the way, of just stop them is not a bad argument. You know, if you don't like that they can, you know, you can lose the coin toss and they can go down the field and score a touchdown and you won't get a chance on offense, well, just stop them. Okay, that's not a bad argument. But here's what Lewis Riddick did not include in his tweet. And I didn't know either until somebody brought my attention to it. In the playoffs, since the new overtime rule went into effect, of the 12 games now that have gone to overtime with these overtime rules in effect, 11 of the 12 have been won by the team that won the coin toss. That ain't 21.5%. And so the reason you would ask is, well, why? Why is the percentage so much different in the postseason? I don't know why, and nobody explains it, but here's a guess from me, just a guess. The best teams and the best quarterbacks are playing in the postseason. I mean, more often than not, that's what it is. I mean, was there any doubt on Sunday night that whoever won that coin toss and got the ball had a pretty damn good chance based on what we had just witnessed over the final 2 minutes of regulation of winning that game on the opening drive? And so I also started to think, in addition to the numbers being completely lopsided in postseason games, 11 of 12 now that won the coin toss won the game. Now, let me point out, not all 11 won the game on the opening drive.
Yes.
7 of the 11, though, won the game on the opening drive. All right, in 2011, it was the Tebow to Demaryius Thomas to beat the Steelers. All right, that would not be an example of a great quarterback, but still, that was the opening drive touchdown. Russell Wilson did it against the Packers, touchdown. Carson Palmer and Larry Fitzgerald did it against the Packers as well in a divisional round game. Brady did it in the Super Bowl. Brady did it against the Chiefs. Kirk Cousins did it against the Saints in the wild card round 2 years ago. They won the toss. He hit Thielen on a bomb and then hit Kyle Rudolph for the game winner. And then on Sunday, Pat Mahomes did it. So of the 11 coin toss winners of the 12 overtime playoff games that won the game, all right, seven of the 11 won with a touchdown on the opening drive. That's a lot. You know, that's a hefty percentage. The other thing,
but it's not 10 out of 11.
No, but still, okay. Well, look, here's the other part of it. Yeah, but 7 out of 11 is a big number. It's a big number. I mean, that is it basically says you lose the coin toss, you're done. And by the way, the 11 out of 12 also says you lose the coin toss, you're done. Because we've only had three instances where the coin toss winner won the game but not on the first drive. In part because they drove it and then they were able to punt somebody deep into bad field position too. You know, that helps as a coin toss winner. But the other thing too, Tommy, that changes when you don't have when you have to avoid one thing as the defensive team on the opening drive of overtime, your strategy can change. I'm not suggesting it does, but it's logical that it does, and that is we can't give up anything big. You know, we can give up plays underneath. We can give them, you know, chunks of the field. We can't give up the big play. It's the only way we lose. If they drive down and kick a field goal, we're good. And so defensively, your strategy now can change. So I now would like to see the overtime rule changed. And Bill Barnwell, you know, from ESPN.com, wrote extensively about this. And actually, there were things about what he wrote I didn't know about all of these different proposals that have been out there for a couple of years. Some of them are crazy. Did you know that the Ravens last year proposed the following to change the overtime rule? They proposed that overtime is decided. The overtime kickoff is eliminated. You eliminate the kickoff, and the coin flip winner gets to choose either taking the ball or the yard line in which the other team will start with the ball. Now, this to me is gimmicky. I'm glad the NFL kind of laughed it off and didn't, you know, adopt it. In that Sunday game, what you would have had if that were the rule, right? The coin toss winner would have taken the ball, and then the other team would have said, yeah, from the 1 yard line. That's where you're going to take it from,
yeah.
You know? There have been several proposals, including just guaranteeing that another team, if the other team scores a touchdown, gets a possession. There's a proposal out there that apparently some people like, which is playing to 8 points. The first team to get to 8 points, which means to end the game with a touchdown on the opening drive, you'd have to go for two. All right. Instead of kicking the extra point, you'd have to go for two to end the game. If you kicked the extra point, the other team would get it. If you missed the 2-point conversion, the other team would get it and then have a chance to win with a touchdown and an extra point. But to me, the easiest thing to do, it's so easy, just play a 15-minute overtime period to its completion. Just play it. Play 15 minutes, and whatever the score is at the end of the 15 minutes, that's your final score. That's football on a 100-yard field with every rule that you play with in the fourth quarter, with no strategy changes that are different from the end of a
game?
Fourth quarter. Then you go to a second.
Then you go to a second. Okay.
Yeah, then you go to a second 15-minute overtime. Or if you safety is the ultimate concern, which is why they went from 15 to 10 in the regular season. You're still at 15 in the playoffs. But, you know, if you want to make the second overtime something that resembles what we have now, okay, because it's so, you know, the chances of that are slim and none. But I would just make it another 15-minute overtime period. For the people that would complain about the safety, whether it's the players' union or the league, we've had 12 overtime games in the postseason since the new rules went into effect in 2010. So basically 12 in 12 years. So an average of one overtime game per year. So one game, you're going to play a 15-minute extra period. Come on, people. That's what they should do. And it shouldn't be 10 minutes, and it shouldn't be 7.5 minutes, and it shouldn't be 12. 15-minute overtime and play the game like we've been watching the game, with special teams, with strategy that reflects fourth quarter game-ending strategy. Have the 2-minute warning. Give teams additional timeouts, you know, which they do anyway. It's 2 extra timeouts, but give them 3 extra timeouts, and let's play it out. To me, that's the easiest thing. By the way, I would do that in the regular season too, but I don't think they will do that ever. I think the regular season, you know, is more, because there's so many more games, you know, safety becomes much more of an issue. But for an average of one overtime a game a year in the postseason, play it out that way. That I'm in favor of that now. I'm very much in favor of that. And I think, by the way, my gut tells me they're going to change to something that won't change the regular season, even though I think the regular season should be changed. You know, even if they keep the same rules, it should be a 15-minute overtime, not a 10-minute overtime. But I think they're going to make a change in this offseason to something that gives, that ensures that a game like that doesn't end again without the other team getting the ball.
I wouldn't have a problem with that. I'd be fine with that. You know, just go ahead and play another period. I'd be okay if it was a 10-minute overtime. Because let's face it, hockey during a regular season, they don't play full 20-minute periods in overtime. You know?
Well, it's 3-on-3, and it's 5 minutes.
That's true. That's true. I mean, in the playoffs, though.
No, in the playoffs, it's regular hockey. Except it's sudden death.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is sudden death. I'd have no problem if they changed it to that. It's just that, I mean, to me, the whining about not getting the ball back and to accommodate that situation in most of the recommendations, to me, is just the final white flag on defense in the NFL. You know? I mean, really. I mean, we've already given up so much as it is. It's the final acknowledgement that defense doesn't matter. And I don't want to do that.
Well, I don't.
Defense should matter.
It definitely should matter. I mean, I think some of my favorite games in NFL history have been some of the lowest scoring games. I've cited this game several times in the past. It wasn't an overtime game. But one of my all-time favorite NFL games was Giants 15, 49ers 13 in the NFC Championship game in 1990 when the Giants with Hostetler went on and won the Super Bowl. You know, in January of 91. I mean, that game, you know, Matt Barr with 5 field goals, just one of the more physical. I mean, you don't even get games like that much anymore because of the rules, but I love games like that. My one issue with limiting the time is the same issue I have in the regular season. And if you go to 10 minutes, the problem with that is You can definitely have a team. We saw it on Sunday with both of these teams, as explosive as they are. Their first two drives of the game were like 7.5 minutes and 6.5 minutes. So if you take the kickoff as the team that won the toss, and you've got one of those super long 7.5 minute drives, then you're not really giving the other team. You're giving the other team a chance with the ball, but they're in a different position with the ball. And you can say, well, stop them before 7.5 minutes. But I just would rather see 15 minutes so you have legitimate, fair, okay, if you go down, whether it's a short drive, long drive, I'm going to have the ball on offense with an adequate amount of time to match you. And by the way, maybe even beat you with two more drives. Who knows? You know, the other thing, by the way, and somebody, a friend of mine, brought this to my attention after my radio show this morning when I mentioned this. He said the one thing, he goes, I agree with you. He goes, I would do just the 15-minute. It's the cleanest. It keeps everything. You know, the NFL will never do what college football has done, which is turn it into a carnival, shooting gallery thing. They're not going to do that. This is the NFL. The college football is going to change what they did last year. The Illinois-Penn State game was a mockery of football. The 9-overtime game where you're just running 2-point plays. Now, I'm sure people under the age of 30 loved it, but if you're a traditionalist, you don't even have to be a traditionalist. If you're a longtime football fan, that was laughable. I mean, that was truly like, you know, putt-putt golf into the clown's nose to try to win the prize. It was stupid. The NFL will never do that. But my friend made one point. He's like, you know, if you play a full overtime period, it can make a great game and very anticlimactically because, you know, let's just say the team that wins the toss goes down and scores. And so it went into overtime at 24-24. Now it's 31-24. Then the other team turns it over and it's a pick six and now it's 38-24. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're going for it on fourth down. They miss and then they score again and it's 45. Like, you could end up with some of those games being blowouts in overtime. That's true. And it would end very anticlimactically compared to the way overtime ends now. But I don't care. I would put up with the games that could end up ending, you know, differently than they ended in regulation from a dramatic standpoint.
Okay. Like I said, I'm fine with that.
Okay.
What I wasn't fine with was the post-game whining on social media. I mean, it was almost childish in their reaction. Well, that's it? I want to see Josh Allen get the ball now. You know? What are you doing to me here?
Well,
just way out of bounds.
Well, you know, Tommy, what happens, too, this kind of brings it full circle from the beginning part of this conversation, and that is when a lot of people that don't watch a lot of football are all of a sudden drawn into this drama, this reality show, you know, unexpectedly, it's like they don't know the rules. And they're like, wait a minute, I don't understand. Why doesn't the guy that wore number 17 that did all those plays just 20 minutes ago, why doesn't he get a chance? You know, so you get a lot of that.
Now, while you were watching that unfold and taking away any financial interest you may have had, who did you want to win that game?
Buffalo.
So did I.
But I did have, so I went 0-3 on the smell test. I still have a chance to get back to 500. But I gave out the two unders on the Sunday games, and I gave out Tampa. I also said I love the unders in the first two games of the weekend, and I like Kansas City. So I gave out three leans, all of which came through, but don't count on my record. And the three official picks were all losers. But the two unders were home runs. I mean, Tampa's down 27-13. That's easily a game 27-6. But even at 27-20, if the Rams get a first down, the total was 48. Game's over, but Akers fumbles, and here we are at 27-27. That game goes over. And then the Bills had to convert a 4th-and-13 at 20, when it was 26-21, or that game would have gone under, which is why, boys and girls, gambling, you know, as as one of my good friends, Joe Preston, always says when we're in Vegas, you know, Vegas, it ain't for everybody. And it's not. I mean, I did play the under and I played Kansas City, But there was part of me, look, I was rooting for Kansas City to win my bet, but there was part of me that really understood that if Buffalo wins this game and they get to host the AFC title game, that would be kind of cool.
Yes.
And God.
I mean, look, I got to think, life is pretty hard in Buffalo. So I really wanted it for them. I mean, it can't be easy living in Buffalo. I'm not downgrading Buffalo. I've been there. It can't be an easy place to live. That's all.
They got great wings, Tommy. They got great wings. But let me just, you know, as you were saying that, okay, here we go. Today, scattered snow showers, high of 22. Tonight, scattered flurries, low of 2 degrees. Tomorrow, it's going to be sunny with a high of 12. Tomorrow night, chance of snow, low of 7. And then it just keeps going. Here's the most encouraging part of the extended forecast for Buffalo, New York. Next Monday, cloudy and 25.
That's a tough life, so I was pulling for them. Plus, look, I mean, Mahomes is great. And, I mean, we may be splitting hairs here, although I don't think so. I mean, Josh Allen put that team on his shoulders.
Oh, he's great. He's great.
You know? I mean, he just did it. I mean, Mahomes does it too, but he's got Tyreek Hill. He's got Kelsey. And I know, you know, they've got Stephon Diggs, Josh Allen. It just seemed like Josh Allen was willing that team to win.
It was, thank you again. This will get us into our next topic, because I think that game and the performances by those two quarterbacks in that game specifically made a lot of people, fans, but more importantly, front offices around the league, rethink everything when it comes to the quarterback position. I want to get to that next, right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. It really helps us. Please rate us and review us if you haven't done that, especially on Apple and Spotify. I wanted to mention one quick thing because I don't know that I mentioned it yesterday on the podcast. I'm supposed to put out, you know, semi-regular Twitter polls for the radio show, which are sponsored by my good friends at Window Nation. They got a great deal going on right now at Window Nation. Go to windownation.com or call them at 866-90-NATION. Buy two, get two free. No money down, no down payments, no interest for 2 full years. In the wake of the quarterbacking display that Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes and Joe Burrow and Matt Stafford, et cetera, you know, put on over the weekend, I just put out a poll that was intended to be very tongue-in-cheek, and I thought people would get it. But I would say I would say the majority didn't get it. I just wrote, the poll was, the offseason priority for the Washington football team should be another wide receiver was one option, Tommy. Middle linebacker was a second option. The third option was a starting guard with offensive line depth. And then I had other. And
I got it. I saw it.
I guess.
I got it.
But it certainly didn't. It didn't have. I thought most people would, I thought, you know, the other category would just say 99.9% and everybody would be saying, ah, funny, you didn't put quarterback in there. But no, most people were like, dude, you forgot quarterback. I didn't forget quarterback. It was a tongue firmly placed in cheek thing that just for whatever reason didn't work. It's funny. My youngest son goes, Dad, was that poll? Are you trolling people with that poll? Or are you serious? Like, he wasn't exactly sure. And then he's like, and I said, no, I was totally, you know, tongue in cheek trolling. And he's like, yeah, I thought so. But a bunch of my friends called and said, your dad forgot to put quarterback in there. What we saw this weekend, especially with Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes, I was thinking about this, and I talked a little bit about it on the show this morning on radio because we were talking a lot about Aaron Rodgers. Let me just first say this on Aaron Rodgers. If he is available and if he actually wasn't opposed to playing in Washington, I would go all in on Aaron Rodgers. My feeling isn't any different than it was a year ago. There's nothing that I saw Saturday night that would change my mind. Nothing. If it costs me three ones and Chase Young, count me the F in. All right? I mean, Aaron Rodgers is going to be a two-time reigning MVP. And for those of you that think he shits the bed in the postseason and he chokes in the postseason and he folds like a cheap suit in the postseason, you're out of your mind. That just isn't true. He did not do enough on Saturday night. That's the game more than any other, and it's the most recent, so I understand that, where you're like, oh my God, he lost at home to the 49ers, and he only put 10 points up on the board. And he wasn't good. The truly elite quarterbacks elevate their team. And they should have won the game. He's an elite quarterback, people. All right? And he hasn't won a Super Bowl since 2011. I understand that. And he's played in a lot of NFC Championship games since then. And they haven't gotten through. But if you go back, Saturday night was the only loss, really, that you can have that feeling, oh my God, Aaron Rodgers didn't get it done. Because at almost every turn, he's gotten it done. And if he didn't, it was because his team was playing a favored team that was just better. Period. Now, if you want to say Tampa wasn't better last year, well, cover Scotty Miller at the end of the half when, you know, it's a Hail Mary thing and Brady finds Miller wide open. That loss was not on Aaron Rodgers. The coach took the ball out of his hands at the end of the game. All right, they have lost games after he threw a Hail Mary and he never touched the ball in overtime against Arizona, after he had an incredible game at Seattle and they recovered an onside kick the Seahawks did and he never touched the ball in overtime. You don't tell me that Aaron Rodgers, if you want to make the case that Aaron Rodgers, you think at 38 years old, that he's now going to hit the wall and start to decline, which is why you would want him for a hefty price. Well, I would just say to you, well, what evidence did he give you this year that he's in decline? Because he's going to win his second straight MVP. But that's a better argument than he can't get it done in the postseason. Do you know Peyton Manning couldn't get it done forever in the postseason? Peyton Manning actually only had one Super Bowl and had a losing playoff record and had a neck injury at 37 years old and then had one of the greatest seasons in the history of seasons and lost in the playoffs again in 2012. And then finally, at the end of his career, you know, ended up winning the Super Bowl with Denver when he wasn't as much of a part of it, but they continued to get there. He got him to a Super Bowl, lost to a much better Seattle team. you know, that particular year. But anyway, I digress, because I'm all in on Aaron Rodgers. He ain't coming here. I mean, that ain't happening. But I'm just, for those of you that actually have this thought that you wouldn't do Aaron Rodgers now after watching him on Saturday night, I think you need your head examined.
Let me just say this.
Okay.
And I tweeted this out about an hour after the final playoff game to give everyone sufficient time to basically wind down. You know, the NFL playoffs is the annual exercise for Washington football fans of showing how far they really have to go to become this.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, really, it's always the stark interest. If you watch the Washington football games closely throughout the season, and then you watch the NFL playoffs, sometimes it's like you're not even watching the same game. And this is an annual exercise, and that's what this is. So I'm curious about the Aaron Rodgers debate, because I would say to Washington fans, wouldn't you rather argue about about losing the NFC Championship game than argue whether Taylor Heineke should be your starting quarterback or not?
It's insane. I just don't.
It really is.
Look,
wouldn't your disappointment rather be we lost another NFC title game?
Yeah, I mean, they didn't get back to the championship game this year, but I think everybody understands your point.
Yeah.
But of course. And the thing is it's not like, okay, it's not like you're going with a quarterback that can't do it. Whether he does it or doesn't do it, time would only tell. But it's not like he can't do it. I mean, the guy's been, you know, a little bit snake bit. His teams have been a little bit snake bit in the postseason in certain games. I mean, he threw a Hail Mary to Jeff Janis in Arizona, and he never touched the ball in overtime. The Seattle recovered an onside kick when that game was over, and he was about to go back to a Super Bowl. I mean, last year, the head coach took the ball out of his hands, you know, at the end of the game in a 5-point loss. By the way, Tom Brady and the Buccaneers. But anyway, this is what I wanted to say, because it dovetails off what you're talking about. I don't think it's just Washington after Sunday night, you know, or the really bad franchises that say, oh my God, we're never going to be that. I think it's a lot of teams. Tommy, I think the performance from Josh Allen and from Patrick Mahomes, the eye-popping performance by both of them. And by the way, just recently, you know, in addition to Josh Allen and Pat Mahomes in the AFC, you've got Justin Herbert, you've got Joe Burrow. You know, you still have Aaron Rodgers playing at a super high level. You've got Matt Stafford, who finally got on a good team that looks more and more like an elite quarterback, although I don't put him in that class with what Mahomes and Allen did. The thinking, any front office that has thought, as Ron Rivera said last year when they didn't get Stafford, it was amazing how quickly he turned to, we're just going to build it from the inside out. We're not going to overspend. We're not going to mortgage our future. We're going to then go get the quarterback after we've got, no. That's all bullshit. And you can't do it. That's not going to work. You saw on Sunday night, two guys, and they're not the only two in the league right now. There's a handful of them. You know, I throw Lamar Jackson into that conversation when he's healthy and what, you know, he plays it differently. Kyler Murray plays it differently. But they played at such an outrageous level that if you don't have one of those, you basically, what are you doing? And so,
well, what if Kyle Shanahan and Jimmy Garoppolo wind up winning the Super Bowl? You don't put Jimmy Garoppolo in that class, obviously.
No. And in fact, I'm wondering if they lose Sunday, or if they beat Matt Stafford and the Rams and lose to, you know, Pat Mahomes or Joe Burrow in the Super Bowl, you know, which would be the second loss in the Super Bowl. I'm wondering if he would say the same thing, like, I got to go get one of them too. Now, maybe Trey Lance is that. But basically, he's already said that. He already admitted that. That, you know, you can't win it without Garoppolo. You can't win it with Garoppolo, excuse me. You gotta aim higher. Look, here's my point. My point is, I think front offices all around the league, if they were predisposed to thinking, you know, if we get a really good quarterback, you know, Matt Stafford, Dak Prescott, on the good level of a Kirk Cousins or a Derek Carr, and we really build around him, we can make a deep run. You know, we can do that. You know, Ryan Tannehill, he's not an elite quarterback, but he's a, you know, when he plays at a good level, he's a top half of the league's, you know, quarterback in the system that we like to run. But I think those teams are even checking themselves saying, what are we doing here? Like, we just have to keep trying to get one of these guys. Because, Tommy, look, there are the examples, obviously, of Garoppolo making a Super Bowl, Jared Goff making a Super Bowl recently, Nick Foles winning the Super Bowl, okay? There are those examples. But I think what you saw Sunday night is basically that's what you have to strive for, because that's going to keep you in contention to be a contender for the Super Bowl year in and year out over a long period of time. The other way you can hit, when you have a tremendous coaching staff and a head coach like Kyle Shanahan who's propping Garoppolo up with an incredible run game and an incredible defense, you can win playoff games. You can maybe even get to a Super Bowl. And who knows? Maybe they'll win it. I don't think they will. But maybe they can, because they are a tough, hard-nosed team. But that's not the way it's going to happen the significant majority of the time. And so it made me think of like two things. One, if you don't have one of those, you better be thinking about the best way to try to get one of those. And if that's in the offseason, you got to take every opportunity to swing big for Aaron Rodgers, Russell Wilson, and Deshaun Watson. But then it led me to thinking about the draft. The draft is always one of those things where when you're talking about quarterbacks, we know what a long shot crapshoot business it is. When you land on one that ends up being Pat Mahomes, it's like a lottery ticket. It's a winning lottery ticket. It's a long shot though. But I think you have to rethink your position on what you're drafting. Like Mac Jones would not be in the conversation for me anymore. A guy like Mac Jones. I would be going for the guy with the biggest ceiling. I wouldn't care how low the floor was. Because I want the superstar. And so when I'm evaluating these quarterbacks, Kenny Pickett, Matt Corral, Carson Strong, Malik Willis, et cetera, this year, I'm not taking the guy that's the safest or the most ready or whatever. I'm taking the guy with the biggest upside. I may fail miserably, but I'm taking the guy that could end up looking like one of the two guys we saw Sunday night. I don't want to end up...
Josh Allen fits that category. When he came out of Wyoming, people didn't think he'd ever be able to throw an NFL complete NFL passes more than 50%.
He was not considered
a good passer.
He had a low floor. You're right. He had one of those floors that people said he's not an accurate passer. Look at his percentages.
Yeah.
I will remind everybody, and most people listening, know this. Cooley said, "You guys are insane. He doesn't have anything. Look at the way he throws the ball. Look at his movement. This guy's going to be a star." And by the way, Buffalo clearly felt the same way. They took him with the seventh pick overall. And who knows how much further he would have gone. Look, Justin Herbert had a lot of the questions of leadership and stuff. I mean, the physical stuff wasn't questioned. But I guess my point is for like Washington, now, after watching Sunday night, I think some front offices will say, we're not taking Mac Jones, and whoever the Mac Jones equivalent is, we're not taking Mac Jones. Okay, he can provide something, but we need to end up with a chance at what we saw Sunday night, or we don't have a chance. By the way, I would also say, especially in the AFC right now, with Herbert and Burrow and Allen and Mahomes and Jackson, my God. Like, if you're an AFC team, like, if you're Denver, you better get Aaron Rodgers. Forget it. You got no shot. If you're Indy, you got to get, Aaron Rodgers.
If you're Washington.
Yeah.
And let's do a reality check here. You're not going to get Aaron Rodgers. You're not going to get Russell Wilson. And you're not going to be foolish enough to trade for Deshaun Watson, while your owner is testifying before Congress in congressional hearings.
Well,
about sexual harassment.
I don't know what the downside would be. I mean, again, how much lower could
again,
they go?
We're talking about a new level of downside.
I don't know
when
if
the
are.
Owner of your football team is brought before a committee on Capitol Hill cameras everywhere testifying. Okay, this is what they want. That's what they want. They want Goodell up there, and they want Dan Snyder up there. Anyway, let's say your reality trade level is Mitch Trubisky type.
No,
you still got a draft. No,
no, that's my point. Fuck Trubisky and Carr and Tyrod Taylor and Marcus Mariota. What's the point
of that? So if
you
can't get any of the elite guys in a trade, you just as soon stick with Taylor Heineke and then draft the guy you want.
No, what I'm saying, let me state it better. What I'm saying is I am going big or it's going halfway home. I'm going big in that I'm going for one of the big three, which I agree with you. I don't think any of the three are going to, you know, ultimately be available. And so now I am going into that draft, and all I am thinking about is who has the highest floor, who has the highest ceiling. I don't care about the floor and how low it is. I'm going for the home run.
You're doing what I'm saying is. You don't make the trade for a quarterback that's not one of the top three, and then you definitely draft a quarterback.
I'm going for the guy with the highest ceiling in the draft. And by the way, I might trade back. If I think there are two guys with super high ceilings, I might trade back into the end of the first to take the other guy. And then...
But you're still looking at Taylor Heineke as your quarterback.
And by the way, you know, from a business standpoint, I can certainly, I think, believe that they can't trot Taylor Heineke out there next year with a new name and the whole thing. So what I'm saying is, at that point, I might sign a very cheap, inexpensive veteran option, you know, a Marcus Mariota or a Tyrod Taylor that I believe is a better option than Heineke. If the guy or the guys I draft, if that ceiling isn't that, you know, is there, but we kind of aren't ready to go reaching for it quite yet. Tommy, my overarching point here is you've got to keep going for what we saw Sunday night, or what's the point? Like, trading for Jimmy Garoppolo, what is that going to give you? You know, 8 wins instead of 7? I mean, trading for Derek Carr, what's that going to get you? Is it going to get you to 9-8 in a wild card berth? You know, it's just, look, if I were, Tennessee, if I were teams, especially in the AFC, I mean, even Tannehill, I'd be thinking about how do I get somebody like what I saw Sunday night? I can't beat these teams with Ryan Tannehill. You know, I'm sure Jacksonville's believing at some point that Trevor Lawrence or, you know, maybe the Jets with their young guy. But Cleveland's got to be thinking, we can't beat these teams with Baker Mayfield. If you're Indy, we can't beat these teams with Carson Wentz. They got to be thinking about how they land on Rodgers, Watson, Wilson, or they strike, you know, a lucky hit in the draft by drafting the guy with the highest ceiling. That's my big takeaway, is I'm going for the guy with the highest ceiling now in the draft. I don't care about how low the floor is, and I am swinging so big and so hard at, you know, the guys that can play the way those guys played on Sunday night. And there are only three of them in terms of veterans available. You know, Wilson, Rodgers, and Watson are the only three. Carr isn't that guy. Garoppolo's not that guy. Trubisky's not that guy. Kirk Cousins isn't that guy. And I'm talking about guys that might be available. I mean, if I'm a team like the Eagles after watching the other night, I'm going for Deshaun Watson or Aaron Rodgers or Russell Wilson with all the draft choices they have. I mean, Jalen Hurts, I like Jalen Hurts. He's better than I think most people thought he would be. Didn't play well in the playoff game, but he was hurt, as it turns out. Had a bum ankle. But you got to be – I think the other night was not a game changer for a lot of teams that were already thinking that way. But I bet you there were a lot of teams, especially in the AFC, that said, what are we doing here? We don't have a choice, if we're Denver. We have to get Aaron Rodgers. We have to. Or we're playing for a 500 record.
So if you're Washington, would you draft two quarterbacks if you had if you felt you had a chance to take a risk on guys like that?
Definitely. Especially given how cheap they are. I mean, quarterback, you know, draft choices in rookie deals are so inexpensive. I mean, the biggest risk is the pick and what you passed over to take, you know, the quarterback. But that's the most important position. So I'm taking – look, there are a lot of people that are evaluating these quarterbacks in this draft and saying it's a horrible draft. And if none of the guys that I evaluate have a big ceiling, then I don't know what I'm going to do, because you don't want to take a guy with a high floor, low ceiling. That's not the way to go anymore. You know, it's just not the way to go. I mean, that can provide you with, you know, a stable franchise, top half of the league guy. You're going to win 8-9 games, sometimes 10 or 11, like if you're Tennessee, and win some divisions.
Maybe that should be the goal for this team.
Well, you know what? This team is different than everybody else. I'm just telling you what I think.
Okay.
You know, front offices watched that game, fans watched that game and said, oh my God, because the performances were so outrageously off the charts, brilliant, and you're looking at these guys and their age and you're thinking, this is the future. Now, it's hard to find them, but, you know, there are going to be 7, 8, 9 teams, maybe 10, that have guys like this over the next 10 years, and they're going to win all the games. And if I don't have one of them, I'm not going to win all the games. I'm going to be doing what, best case, what Tennessee's been doing here the last couple of years. That's my big upside. I guess you could say what San Francisco has done. But, man, those are
I can't argue with it. I can't argue with it. It shows a level of vision. I kind of like it. But for this team, for your team, I think you have to be satisfied with being respectable.
Look, I don't
know, for not being embarrassing.
Can I just tell you something? Because I said something this morning on radio. I think I've said it before here, but a lot of people responded to me favorably, more so, you know, people my age or, you know, older, longer term fans. But I just said, you know, we're basically 8 days away from this 2-2-22. I just don't think that organization has any clue as to how completely jarring and the negative reaction to this thing, or the complete and utter apathetic reaction to this thing from so many of the fans out there. I think it's going to feel like the end. They are touting this is a new beginning, and I think for a large percentage of people who were fans or still are barely fans, it's going to end it. Boom, done. Because it'll be for the first time since July of 2020, it'll be the first time that they realize, oh my God, it's not my team anymore. It's a totally different team. Because you know, over the last two seasons, Washington football team, colors are the same. I know the colors are still going to be the same. The uniforms, for the most part, with the exception of the helmet, look the same. You know, it's gonna be a lead weight.
I think you're right. I think it will. What I find curious is this whole narrative of turning the page, a new start. I mean, does that mean there'll be no more talk about Joe Gibbs and his three Super Bowls? Do they leave that behind too? Will they take the Super Bowl trophies at the parking lot event they're going to have at FedEx Field and melt them down and mold a giant commander for their new team?
What are the trophies made out of? Are they gold?
Oh, I don't know.
I was going to say melt it down and use it to pay off all the victims of all the of all the lawsuits you're going to have to settle.
I always find this and Bruce Boudreau finally figured this out with the Capitals. When you sign on for this team, you sign on for the good and the bad. You can't just say, you know, we're not going to live in the past. The past is part of who you are. The three Super Bowl trophies and the 20 years of embarrassment, it's all part of every time you put on that uniform, when you coach, you inherit all of it. or none of it. Either all of it or none of it.
The fan, well, I think that will stay a part of this franchise's history. They're not going to ignore.
Well, of course they will. But my point is, it's hypocritical to say we're not going to live in the past, and then talk about Joe Gibbs all the time.
I think when they say we're not going to live in the past, it would be more like the last 22 years of past.
Yeah, I know.
It would be nice not to live under those conditions. I think there are people that are excited about 2222. God bless you. All right. And if you've been sticking with this team throughout and you haven't been impacted, like somebody like me, one of the all-time, diehards like many of you, it was such an important part, probably an outsized and inappropriate part of my life for so long. But I just feel so differently now. And, some of that could be chalked up to getting older and maybe it would have happened anyway. But really, 95% of it can be chalked up to what this owner has done over the last 22 years. It's the losing and it's the embarrassing behavior and the insulting, et cetera. It's different. I don't have the same level of passion for this team anymore. Not at all. I mean, we already talked about this last week when I said I couldn't even, summon up enough energy to root against the Cowboys in the playoffs. Like, who gives a shit? I mean, most people out there that were saying that weren't even going to get your own games. I mean, without the Cowboy fans, you wouldn't have had a full stadium at any point this year. But I think when we get to 2222, there's a very large percentage of people who were either already feeling the way I was, already checked out, or have sort of been, following it and into it, but are a little bit queasy as to how they're going to feel. And those people are in for a big, rude slap in the face because it will be jarring. It'll be for the first time we lost our team. We lost everything about our team. This is the brand connection, the emotional brand connection that happens in any consumer product. And this one especially that has been around for 80-something years, the attachment you had was a lot to things that weren't even things that happened on the field. And when they say Washington Commanders, and the uniform has the same colors, but it's a different looking uniform, and the helmet's a little bit different, and they start with all of these, know-nothings that are out there now that have been there for 5 minutes, start talking about, new songs, new fight songs, and they start, asking for recommendations for new fight songs and new things that can be attached to the new thing, and they name another part of the stadium after Sean Taylor, you guys are going to be out permanently. That will be it. That'll be the nail in the coffin. I feel it coming, Tommy. I swear. I feel it coming.
Well,
for a lot of people.
Well, I mean, when they got rid of Redskins, no matter what your position was on the name, and I wrote a column about this, and I think some fans may feel this way. Maybe more feel the way you do. I think a lot of fans feel they lost their team a long time ago.
Yes.
And, I mean, they have not been the team that you fell in love with for a while. And they have not been the team deserving of your love for quite a while.
I think you're right. I don't think there's any doubt about it that a lot of people were gone on that day. But I also think that those people with Washington football team and Washington being a big part of the brand and the colors and the uniforms looking the same were always within reach. I think the new name and everything else puts them completely out of reach. And I think for the people that have been, okay, whatever, but it's going to be a complete shock when all of this stuff rolls out. It's going to really hit home, I think. I mean, people understand it. They can project what it's going to be, but I don't think they're going to know until it actually 8 days from now gets rolled out. And by the way, I'm not discounting the fact that this team will be targeting a lot of people that don't remember the Super Bowls and, you know, are looking for kind of a new team. It's very much an expansion kind of rollout. I really feel that way, and that's who they're going to be targeting. Younger people that haven't rooted for the team because they've sucked for so long, and they're going to be able to introduce this team to that group and that demographic as if it is something new. So best of luck with that. Speaking of that, the local television ratings for NFL teams were put out by our good friend John Orand from Sports Business Journal. I wanted to talk about that and maybe a couple of other things that maybe you haven't gotten to. We'll do that right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Just to let everybody know, tomorrow is the 30-year anniversary of Washington's Super Bowl 26 win over Buffalo. On the radio show tomorrow morning, I've got Charlie Casserly, who's going to be with me at 7 a.m. Right now, tentatively, Mark Rippon will be a part of the show. Jeff Bostic's going to be on radio with me tomorrow morning at 8. And Frank Herzog, who was obviously part of the most famous and iconic radio booth in D.C. sports history, Frank, Sonny, and Sam. Frank will be with me at 8:30. And we will also have a special guest, 91 anniversary related, on the podcast tomorrow as well. 30 years ago. Wow. I was there, Tommy. I was there for that Super Bowl.
You want to leave that past behind.
Let's leave it behind. Want to leave that past behind. So our friend John Oran from Sports Business Journal, John does such a great job, has a really good podcast, too, with Andrew Marchand that you can listen to wherever you get a podcast. So he put out in his latest newsletter the regular season local market television ratings for all of the NFL markets. Now, let me just say this, because I know you're going to get to it, that not everybody watches games on TV anymore. There are lots of different ways to, you know, watch these games, to consume these games. There are a lot of, you know, people, young people doing it in different ways where, you know, it wouldn't register in the ratings, whatever. But still, we have the local TV ratings. So Washington, the Washington market for the Washington football team, did an average local rating for their 17 games this year of a 16.6. That's not good, people. It's not good. It's
but
really,
I think it's better than last year.
It is barely better. Last year was a 16.5, right?
Yes.
But, you know, last year was a weird year. I mean, it was a good year in that they ended up making a run and they ended up playing in the postseason. But the COVID year, like almost 21 of the 32 NFL markets were up this year from 2020. So if that gives you any sense. So basically two-thirds of the league's teams were up in television ratings. But anyway, 16.6, just to give you an idea before I tell you where it ranks in the league, the 16.6 is basically half of the audience that they would have had on average 10, 12 years ago. I mean, it's been in steady decline for a long time now, as we know, and we've referred to these, you know, hideous local TV ratings, you know. But most of the time, we've just been sort of comparing it to what it used to be in this market, you know, and you can basically say roughly without me having the 2010 or the 2012 numbers in front of me, I guarantee you in 2012, Washington was in the high 20s, low 30s as an average for the year. I can tell you this, the playoff game against Seattle that they had during the RG3 season did a 50 rating locally, 50 for that one game. The Cowboy game, which got them into the postseason in a regular season game, did a 42 local rating. So that year, I'm assuming they averaged well over a 30. So they're now at 16-6. So the audience is essentially half of what it was 10 years ago. That's probably a pretty good estimation. And we've said that they've chased off at least half the fan base, if not more than it. We know where they are in local attendance. They're dead last in attendance. And without the opponent's fans in that stadium, you wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't have had, I think I did the back of the envelope on this, Tommy, that their 51,000 plus paid attendance number, that it was actually, actual average attendance was about 40,000 for games this year. And I estimated that 60% on the season were there to watch Washington. So like 24,000 people basically bought tickets and went to games who were actual Redskin fans, Washington football team fans. Okay, that is, I mean,
that's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. And then you factor that with a 16-6 local TV rating. You can see that when I've said to you guys with Tommy or without him that this podcast and all of the discussion about the team, which we all enjoy, it's very much a bubble. I mean, you know, it's and I love the bubble and I love all of you that are part of it, and I thank God for it. Trust me, but it really is a bubble because half the fan base, now, by the way, half the fan base doesn't mean that they're not listening to this podcast, even if they're not watching the games or going to the games. Not everybody listens to this podcast or the radio show, especially those that listen when Tommy's on. Not everybody's just listening to Tommy and I together because you're Washington football team fans. We understand that, and we're appreciative of that. Anyway, the point being, they've chased away roughly half of what the fan base was 10 years ago, and probably more than half, I would guess. Now, where does it rank? 25th. The 16.6 is 25th out of the 32 teams locally. But I want to point out that the markets, the seven that had worse local television ratings, first of all, the worst ratings in local TV ratings in the league were the Jets and the Giants, two horrific teams this year. In a city, by the way, that even when the Giants and Jets have been really good, they'd never produced the numbers that a Washington or a Dallas or a Boston, or when you get smaller market, Green Bay or New Orleans, they've never produced those numbers. It's New York. Football isn't king in New York necessarily. You know, it's same in L.A. You know, two of the markets that are behind Washington are the Chargers and the Rams. Well, they're kind of new to their cities for the most part. And it's L.A. Miami, Houston, and Atlanta were the other three teams that had worse local TV ratings. The best local television ratings in the NFL, Buffalo, that place you were referring to earlier, 47.2 was their average local TV rating. So nearly half of the people with televisions were watching Bills games when they were on. Other markets that were outstanding, Milwaukee, you know, for the Packers, 41.6 on average. The Saints, 40.9. Kansas City, 45.3. Lots of markets in the 30s and the high 20s. You know, Cincinnati was good this year, hasn't been a great team. You know, they averaged 28.8 local TV rating, Baltimore to 28. You know, so, you know, Detroit, not a good team, much better local rating than Washington, did a 21. I'm looking for other teams that had rough years. Chicago, rough year, much better than Washington at a 22.2. I mean, Seattle didn't have a good season, a 31.4. Washington really, you know, 25th out of 32 teams, but really bad compared to what it used to be. So anyway, you know, the other thing too, I always mention this when we have these conversations. I do realize that the 16.6 local television rating for Washington 17 games this year is a much bigger number than any of the other local teams. I do understand that. I mean, the Nats, the Caps, and the Wizards would kill for an average rating of 16.6. I mean, they're in the low single digits in terms of local television ratings for regular season games.
Right, and to be fair, the Nats games. Play 162 games
yeah,
a year.
I understand.
And the Wizards and the Caps play right. 82 games a year.
But, you know, if you were to eventually, of course, you don't have this opportunity. Actually, I don't know what the Washington-Tampa game did last year. I'll ask John one of these days. But, like, to try to create, like, the apples to apples, you would do the, you know, a Washington football playoff game. Or maybe just a Washington football regular season game against one of those other teams' playoff games. And then you get to something more comparable. Anyway, what else did you have for the show today? You said you wanted to mention something.
Well, today, this afternoon, probably by the time, probably after the podcast is out, the Baseball Hall of Fame is going to announce the results of their 2022 Hall of Fame ballot. And the expectation is that Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, among the other cheaters, will probably miss. Again, just fall short, and that would be their last year of eligibility on the ballot.
Wow.
If Bonds and Clemens don't get in, then they're done, and then they have to go to the select committee that, you know, votes on these, and I think their chances of getting in dramatically decline once other Hall of Famers are voting on their candidacy, because most of the Hall of Famers do not want either of these guys up there with them on a stage at one point.
All right, you're a Hall of Fame voter, so tell me who you voted for in your ballot, because you always do.
Okay, you know, I didn't vote for Barry Bonds. I didn't vote for Roger Clemens. I didn't vote for Sammy Sosa. I didn't vote for Manny Ramirez or Alex Rodriguez. I didn't vote for David Ortiz. Now, David Ortiz might get in, because he's beloved and revered. I didn't vote for David Ortiz to be consistent in my position on steroids. David Ortiz's name came up on the 2003 positive test list that was published by the New York Times and not refuted by Major League Baseball.
Repeat to everybody that hasn't heard it, your stance as a Hall of Fame baseball voter with respect to guys that were even linked in any way, shape, or form to steroids is?
Well, and linked in any way, shape, or form, I mean linked through some kind of legal document or through some kind of internal official document, drug testing, however. In other words, suspicion, I don't vote on suspicion. You know, Mike Piazza was suspected of using steroids. I voted for him. His name never came up in an investigation, a court hearing, or anything like that. All the guys I vote or I have not voted for, everyone who I've mentioned, you know, did have some kind of circumstantial evidence to connect them to steroid use. And so, you know, I don't vote for those guys. People say, well, you know, how do you know who used steroids and who didn't? Maybe a lot of others did. And I said, but I know these guys did.
Right.
I said, you know, I don't know who else did or didn't, but imagine a justice system where we said, well, you can't judge anyone if you don't judge everyone.
So who did you
vote
caught,
for? I voted for three guys. I voted for Jeff Kent, who's not going to get in. He usually gets about 30-35%. He had 800 RBI seasons as a second baseman.
How many years has he been on the ballot?
I don't know.
It's been a lot.
He may be close to the end.
Yeah. Right? Okay.
He may be close to the
how
end.
Many,
I voted for Billy
how
Wagner.
Many years you can be on the ballot for 10 years, right? If you're not...
10 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
you
Jeff...
be on the ballot for 10 years.
Jeff Kent.
I voted for Jeff Kent. I voted for Billy Wagner. I think he's the one closer who has not been put in the Hall of Fame that probably should be put in. I voted for Scott Rolen. That was a change for me. The Scott Rolen people convinced me that... The third baseman is probably a borderline Hall of Famer.
How did they convince you? What did they send you?
Well, I went back and I looked at his record. I mean, you know,
good
more
cigars.
Closely.
Yeah.
No, not that they didn't convince him to buy me off kind of thing.
You'd be easy to buy.
Yes, I would be. You know, he had 316 home runs, 1,300 RBIs. He was a seven-time All-Star, an eight-time Gold Glove winner.
Wow.
As a third baseman. So I voted for Scott Rowland as my third, and that's it. I voted for three guys. You know, typically in the past, I've been a very
generous voter. What did Rowland hit for his career?
He had 281.
Okay.
Normally, I don't vote 281 hitters
right
into the Hall of Fame unless they've got some other stat that makes them stick out. And his eight Gold Gloves.
Does Rowland have a shot?
Make that stick out. His candidacy is rising. If he doesn't get in this time, and he probably won't, there's a chance he may get in next year.
Mm-hmm.
His candidacy has gone up.
So I want to make sure I'm clear on this. On the ballot for the final time, Bonds, Clemens, and did you say Schilling?
Schilling too. Yeah. I don't even count him. The guy said he doesn't want to be on the ballot. Even he came out this year and said he doesn't want the baseball writers to vote for him. I accommodated him. I didn't vote for him.
When does A-Rod get to the ballot?
He's on the ballot this year.
He is, okay.
And for his first time so far, you know, there's a guy, I forget the guy's name, he does a great job of tracking Hall of Fame ballots based on writers who reveal their ballots early. And based on, I think about 50% of the ballots have been revealed at this point. Through the writer's admissions. And A-Rod was trending at about 46%. When Bonds and Clemens first got on the ballot, they trended at like 36, 35%.
Ooh, interesting. Interesting.
But again, here's what happened. So this is what's, I mean, right now, Bonds and Clemens trend at 77%, and you only need 75% to get in. But everyone knows traditionally, it's the half of the ballots that aren't revealed before the results are announced that torpedo these guys. You know, that most of the time, the ballots that are not revealed consist of voters who do not vote for these guys, like me.
Refresh my memory. How many people can you vote for?
You can vote for up to 10.
Okay.
And there have been years where I voted for 10 guys.
But just three this year.
Yeah,
Roland,
it's not a great ballot.
Roland, Wagner, and Kent.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not a great ballot. I just pulled up the ballot.
No. If you eliminate the steroid guys, it's not a great ballot.
Right, because going down the list, obviously, you know, Sosa's still on it. Pettit's still on it. Ramirez is still on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now listen, just to reiterate, steroids, even though they didn't test for it, steroids were banned by baseball in 1991.
Right.
The reason they didn't test for it is the union stopped the efforts by the owners to implement drug testing. It wasn't the owners. It was the players' union. And the players' union only changed that when they got dragged before Congress during the steroid hearings, and their players decided they didn't want to be embarrassed anymore on national TV on Capitol Hill. That's when the union caved and agreed to stricter drug testing. So steroids have been banned since 91. Barry Bonds is an admitted steroid user. He admitted in grand jury testimony that he used, quote, the cream and the clear, but he claimed he didn't know what they were. Okay.
What year?
Roger Clemens' name is prominently displayed in the Mitchell Report, which, unlike the cheerleaders and many of the baseball writers, call me crazy, but I have a lot of confidence in a two-time United States senator who was the guy who founded peace in Northern Ireland. You know?
Can I just go back to Bonds for 1 minute? Because I think he's the one, you know. I mean, Clemens, too. But, I mean, Barry Bonds is, you know, just the thought of him not being a Hall of Famer is crazy to some people, but we all know the reason why. But one of the arguments, and you can help me with this because I'm not an expert in this area, but What about the argument that says that Bonds had a Hall of Fame career before he started using steroids in Pittsburgh and his, you know, first few years in San Francisco?
Right. Well, you know what? To me, that's a bigger indictment than anything else. He didn't have to cheat to achieve Hall of Fame. He basically cheated because he was jealous.
Tommy, what year did he start?
Cheated.
He started
right after the 98 Sosa McGuire race.
Right.
Because he was jealous of all the attention they were getting.
Right. So he had, what, a 10, 11-year career before then? So let me just ask you the question. Did he have a Hall? If he had retired before the 99 season or before the 99 season, would he be in the Hall of Fame?
Yes.
Okay.
He would. And also, I might want to point out that, you know, of the criteria for, there's six criteria for election to the Baseball Hall of Fame. Three of them are character, integrity, and contributions to the game.
Yep.
I value those. Some people don't. And if they get in, fine. That's what the membership wants. That's fine. They get in. That's the way it is. That's the way it was decided. I just don't think they're going to get in. And let me point out for the people who say the writers hated Barry Bonds, they voted him the NFL and the NL MVP seven times. That was the baseball writers who did that.
Right. Yeah, I mean he was an unbelievable player.
Yeah. But he was a cheater.
Yep.
And he cheated for all the pettiest of reasons. Some guys cheated to save their jobs. Some guys cheated so they could have
jobs.
A major league career.
Yeah.
Yes. This guy cheated because he was jealous.
All right. Every year, Tommy. Big part of this. Is this a big thing for you? I mean, how many years have you been a Hall of Fame baseball writer, a voter?
Probably 19 years.
It's
a big deal. It's probably the coolest thing I do.
Yeah.
Besides this podcast with you, of course.
it is a cool thing that you get to do.
Yeah. It's the thing that makes people light up when I tell them I do it, and it's all they want to talk about.
Well, I mean, it's quite an introductory, you know, thing for you. I mean, it's, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce you to our guest this evening, our guest speaker. He is a 19-year Hall of Fame baseball voter. And by the way, had one of the coolest radio shows, and what a podcast he is a part of twice a week.
You know, I also vote for the Boxing Hall of Fame.
I know that. I know that. Yeah.
Yes.
God, you just reminded me of something. So after the game on Sunday night, I think I tweeted this out. Yes, I did, because somebody said, he said, Tommy would be proud of you. And I said, you know.
I know. I saw it.
Oh,
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. Because
the Hagler-Hearns.
Well, that's what I thought of. I thought of, I'm like, you know, these final 2 minutes are going to be watched over and over again for years to come. You know, people will be on YouTube 15 years from now saying, I want to go watch the final 2 minutes of that game. Or if somebody hadn't seen it, you know, you got to go watch the final 2 minutes of Bills Chiefs. I mean, that's the all-timer. Because the comp for me is Hagler-Hearns. Like, whenever somebody says they haven't seen Hagler-Hearns, I insist that they spend, you know, 9 minutes, because that's what it is. It's not even a full nine. But if you get a little bit of the prelim and a little bit of the post-fight, you know, it's 10 to 12 minutes. Spend 10 to 12 minutes and watch
Yes. The
three rounds of Hagler-Hearns. You will not be disappointed, and you will say, thank you for turning me on to that. And I think that, you know, the final 2 minutes of the Bills-Chiefs game will be the same thing. That was crazy.
I like it. It's a good comparison.
But your fight... Foreman Lyle, that 5-round fight that you turned me on to is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I remember you're like, you haven't seen Foreman Lyle? I have not seen it. And I went and watched it on YouTube, and I'm sitting there, I'm like, oh my God, it just kept getting better and better. All right.
Ron Lyle, who learned how to box in prison. That was the days when you could learn how to fight box in prison.
Yeah.
Bernard Hopkins learned how to box in prison.
Yeah, so did... Oh, God. Who was the light heavyweight champ for many years who came at, right out of prison? Matthew. I'm forgetting.
Matt Franklin?
No.
Matthew Saad Muhammad?
Yeah, Matthew Saad Muhammad. Wasn't he?
Okay, yeah.
Well, he was right out of jail.
I don't know if he was. I don't know if he was or not.
Well, I'm thinking of somebody
else.
Well,
that's when the light heavyweight division was great.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was great light heavyweight then.
I thought there was somebody that during that era that was
Look,
a light heavyweight.
Look, there was a guy named James Scott.
Yeah. I remember him.
Who fought. While he was in
prison,
Rahway State
in prison at Rahway,
and they showed the fight
on
yes.
ABC's Wide World of Sports.
Yes, they yeah. showed him. They showed the fight. I tell you what, you're thinking of Dwight Muhammad. Dwight Muhammad Kawi.
That's who I'm
He's
thinking
the guy
of. That's who I'm thinking yes. of. Yes.
Yeah.
Didn't he fight also in prison? Maybe.
I think so. I think he did. What a great fighter he was.
Great fighter.
What a great tough fighter. Yeah.
All right, we're done. Back tomorrow. To celebrate 30 years ago tomorrow, the Super Bowl champion Washington Redskins over the Buffalo Bills. All right, Tommy, enjoy the beach, enjoy your cigar, enjoy your beers, and be careful with phone numbers on dollar bills. Back tomorrow.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.